The daf for today is Ayin Tes. As an introduction to the beginning of the daf, without reading it inside, I'll just give you a quick summary of the last piece of Gemara on daf Ayin Ches Amid Beis. The Gemara quotes a brisa that records a machlokes tanoim about the status of a shtar chov. A shtar chov means that if Reuven lends money to Shimon, Shimon gives Reuven, the lender, a shtar. And that document in the hands of the lender, of the malve, is a very powerful tool. However, once the borrower has paid up the debt, that shtar is just, you know, it's worthless. It really has no significance. It's only significant up until the moment that the borrower pays back his debt. And why do I mention this? Because the question is, if somebody carries into a Rishus HaRabim, a Shtar Chov, a loan document, whether or not he's going to be liable for violating Melechas Hotzon. It all depends on whether it has Chashivus, whether it has any significance.
So whether it's active or not.
Correct. If it's active, then it's a major tool. It's almost worth, I would say, 99.9% of the face value of the document is concerned. But if, on the other hand, it has no value because the loan is history, it's already been paid back, then it should be absolutely meaningless and worthless. And therefore, when you carry it, it has no value whatsoever, no significance, and therefore you'd not be liable. And here we have machlokes between Rabbi Yehuda and the Chachamim. Rabbi Yehuda says that even if the borrower, the lova, had paid up, nevertheless, there is still a value to the shtar. And the reason for that is because, quote-unquote, mipnei shetzorech lo, he needs the shtar. And our Gemara today is going to try to figure out, what does Rabbi Yehuda mean when he says he needs the shtar? And the Gemara now is going to offer a couple of different possibilities. First of all, one possibility is to say that according to the Chachamim, once the borrower pays up the loan, the lender is not allowed to hold on to the shtar. He's obligated, according to the Jewish ethical law, to get rid of it, because to leave it around is a very dangerous kind of thing. He may mistakenly and inadvertently come to collect the chov, this loan, a second time around, not realizing and not remembering that he's already been paid up. Whereas Rabbi Yehuda holds that you're allowed to hold on to this shtar, and we'll see exactly what value it has, but the lender is allowed to hold on to the shtar. So therefore, according to the Chachamim, they disagree with Rabbi Yehuda. They say that once the loan was paid up, the borrower, the lender, the malva, has to get rid of the shtar, and therefore it's worthless, and therefore you're not chayv hotzah. And Rabbi Yehuda says you're allowed to hold on to the shtar. So the Gemara now, at the very tippy end of Ayin Ches Amid Beis, all an introduction to Hadaf for today, the Gemara quotes Abaye. And Abaye wants to add another element, another dimension into this whole equation. He doesn't believe that Rabbi Yehuda would allow for the malve to hold on to the shtar once it's been paid up. That's similar to what the Gemara calls in Ksuvis, holding on to a Sefer Torah, which is invalid, which is possible, it's been disqualified. You're always afraid somebody might mistakenly think it's a valid Sefer Torah. So the various laws about what you have to do with the Sefer Torah to avoid such a thing. So Abai claims that everybody agrees, even Rabbi Yehuda, that the malva would have to get rid of the shtar once it was paid up. However, the case here that we're dealing with is that the malva claims that the loan was never paid up. The lova, on the other hand, claims that he did pay up. Now, the very moment that the lova admits that the shtar is a valid shtar. In other words, he's not claiming that the shtar was a forgery. He's just claiming he paid up. At that point, by virtue of the the implicit confession or admission on the part of the lover that the shtar is a valid shtar, according to Rabbi Yehuda at least, the shtar is now valid. What does that mean, it's valid? It doesn't have to be authenticated. Normally, every document in Jewish law has to be authenticated. We have to, there are a number of different ways how to authenticate a shtar, but let's take the classic way would be to invite the two witnesses whose names appear on the shtar and have them recognize their signatures. So Rabbi Yehuda, in our case, says this shtar doesn't need verification. And the reason for that is because the lover, by claiming that he paid up the chov, is implicitly admitting that the shtar is a valid shtar. It was not a counterfeit. On the other hand, the Chachamim hold, now, this shtar, if it cannot be authenticated, then we believe the lover to say he paid it up, and the shtar itself is worthless. And therefore the Chachamim say you're not chayev for hotzah if you carry out this shtar. And that leads us to Daf Ayin Tes Amud Aleph. And we're going to start with Rava. That's the end of the first line on Daf Ayin Tes Amud Aleph. Rava Omar Dekuli Alma Modu, even according to Rabbi Yehuda, Modu B'Shtar Sheksavo Tzorech L'Kaimo. Despite the fact that the lova who borrowed the money confesses that the shtar is not a forgery, it's a valid shtar, it's authenticated, you still have to authenticate the shtar. Which means that according to Rava, when the Rabbanon established this enactment, which means that a shtar is always suspect of being a counterfeit, you know, it's so easy for a person just to forge signatures, then until we verify the shtar, it's worthless. And everybody agrees it's worthless. V'hacha, but what's the debate here between Rabbi Yehuda and the Chachamim? Bekosvin shovar kamiflegi. And that means a shovar is a receipt, which under normal circumstances, when the lova pays up a debt, he demands from the malva who lent him the money that he receive some sort of documentation called a shovar that will testify to the fact that indeed he paid up his chov. Tanakama sovar kosvim shovar. According to Tanakama, what happens is that the malve writes a shovar that's called kosvim shovar. He writes this receipt. In modern Hebrew, they call it a kabbalah, if you've heard that phrase. But in Talmudic language, it's called a shovar. And therefore, once he writes that receipt, then the malve has no use for the original loan document. Why? Because the lova is now equipped with a receipt, so the loan document itself is worthless. That's going to be the shita of the Tanakhama, the Chachamim. Rabbi Yehuda,
why wouldn't they just sign the original document?
Well, let's say the original document is now not to be found. You know, the malva comes to the lova and he says, yeah, you got to pay me up. So the lova, if all things were perfect, he would demand that the shtar itself be written on. But in the absence of the shtar, the lova says, well, I'm not going to pay you up until you give me a receipt. Now, once the malva makes that swap, you know, he gets the money from the lova and he gives the lova a receipt, at that point the original shtar, wherever it is, you know, it's valueless, according to the Chachamim. But Rabbi Yehuda Savar ein kosvin shovar. Rabbi Yehuda says that the malva does not write a receipt to the lova, which means that even after the loan is paid up, the malva still needs the shtar. And the shtar would be very valuable to him. Rav Ashi has an alternative pshat here. He says, "Mipnei shetzorech lar oso lebalchov sheni." Says Rav Ashi, it could very well be that the malve, if he would carry out this shtar into Rishus Arabim, everybody would agree that he's not liable, because the shtar in the hands of the malve is meaningless. But you know who dropped this shtar, or who carried this shtar? It was the lova. It was the borrower. Now, why does the borrower need the shtar? And the answer is, mipnei shetzorech lar oso lebalchov sheni. If let's say that this borrower down the line will come into a pressing situation, a need, where he has to borrow more money, and that's very often the case, so he wants to hold on to this shtar. Why? Because when he gets back the shtar from the malve, that testifies to the fact that he has paid up his chov. That gives him what you'd call good security, or good. He has a good track record. Like, for example, today in modern society, if you want to take out a loan, or for example, if you want to take a credit card, you want to sign up for a new credit card, they want to see your credit rating. And it's very interesting. This is true in modern society. I had this experience. You know, sometimes you never took any loan. Your credit rating is lower than somebody who borrowed money. It's a funny kind of thing, but the Gemara also has the same sociology, that if the lova could prove that he once borrowed money but he paid up on time, in due time, then he has a great credit rating. And therefore, that's called Tzorech Larosa Lebalchov Sheni. He needs to show it to a second creditor in event that he borrows money a second time around. D'yomar Lei, he turns to the potential lender and he says to him, "Mr. Lender, I need $1,000 from you. I have a good track rating. What's my track rating? Chazi, see? Gavra de Parano. I'm a person who is good for his word, and I took a commitment and I paid up in the past. Here's my track record." And he shows him the shtar. And that's going to be the shita now of Rabbi Yehuda. The Tanakhama holds that the lover, once he pays up the chov, he doesn't have any real use for the shtar. What are the chances that he'll need the shtar down the line? But Rabbi Yehuda holds, we assume there's a good chance that he might need the shtar to prove his credit rating. Okay, now that really, what we discuss now really belongs to Shabbos, to yesterday's Shia. I don't mean Masech to Shabbos, but okay. So now we start the daf for today. The Mishnah discusses the minimum amount of hide. Hides were made obviously from animal skins that would generate a liability if you carried it out into Rishus HaRabin. And the Mishnah establishes Kidei Laso Spo Kamiya, that he has enough of a piece of a hide that has the dimensions to create an amulet. And as we've mentioned many times in the past, amulets were very, very important in the days of the Talmud. Boyamine Rava Mirav Nachman. Rava raised the following question to Rav Nachman. Hamotzi Ar Bekama. Well, the truth is that we don't understand Rava's question. Rava's asking, how much of a hide does he have to take out to be liable? Amale. So Rav Nachman responds to Rava, and he says, "Kidisnan, it's explicit in the Mishnah. You must be asking a more sophisticated question than that. Or Kidei Lasos Kamiya. You took out enough of a piece of hide that you could create an amulet. Ah, no, what was I asking?" says Rava. "Hama Abdo Bekama. Let's say you have natural hide and it has to be tanned. And tanning is one of the 39 malachas. And right now I have a raw material and I want to really perfect it by tanning it. How much of a hide do I have to tan in order to be considered a tanner? You know, I've tanned something." Amalei, so Rav Nachman said, "Lo shna." You know, it's just like in the case of carrying, we say you're chayav because you carried out a piece of hide the size of which can make an amulet. So too in tanning, in that malach of ma'abed, if you tanned a piece of hide that was long enough and wide enough to create an amulet, you're chayev. Li abdo bekama. Now Rav asks Rav Nachman another question. When you're talking about Hama'abdo, you're talking about someone who, just 1 second, he tans the hide on Shabbos. That was the original question. Now Rav is asking, what about carrying in Rishus HaRabim, or from Rishus to Rishus, an untanned hide? Omo Lelo Shna. Just like you're chayev for carrying out a tanned hide, because you carried out enough to make an amulet out of it, so the same thing should apply to an untanned hide. Now, Rava was a little perplexed by this, because if you have a tanned hide, okay, it's ready to be made as an amulet, but if it's a non-tanned hide in its natural raw state, maybe you'd have to take out more of a piece of hide in order for that to have the chashivus, the same significance, as a tanned piece of hide. A tanned piece of hide has been processed, it's been manufactured, it's ready to make the amulet. But in the case of an untanned hide, you know, that has to go through a lot of processing. So right now it doesn't have the value and the significance. Maybe we should require a greater shear. And Rav Nachman says, no. It makes no difference whether it's tanned or it's raw. Because even in the case of raw, since you took out enough of a hide that if we were to tan it, we could make an amulet out of it, then this is really the raw material. This has the potential to create that amulet. This may remind you of a Gemara that we discussed about wine, that you're chayef for taking out one quarter of a revius wine, because that quarter of concentrated wine, if you just add three parts of water, has the potential to create a revius of yayin. Here too, the untanned hide has the potential to create a tanned hide, the likes of which would make an amulet. Minat temra. Rava says to Rav Nachman, how do you know such a thing? How do you know that we judge the malacha of hotzah in an untanned hide the same way we would in a tanned hide? How do you know that the untanned hide, based on its potential to be tanned, has the same shiurim, the same minimal amount, as already a manufactured hide? So Rav Nachman answers, kidisnan. Okay, there's a mishnah a little bit later on, in the 13th parak, hamalabin. So now we have a list here in this mishnah of various malachas that belong to weaving, and after they shear the wool off the back of the sheep, the first thing they do is they whiten it, and then menapets, they have to untangle it, and then tzoveh, they have to dye it, and then hatoveh, he has to spin it into threads. Shi'uro, what's the minimum amount for any violation of any of the above, of four different malachos? They all have the same minimum shear, and that is kimlo rochav hasit kaful. So sit, if you take a look at my, you remember piece now, right, that's the distance between the pointer and the middle finger, okay, and if you double that, that's called kaful, so that's the shear for all the malachos that we mentioned before that have to do with ariga, with weaving. And ha'orek shnei chutim, now you have two threads. What happens is, there are the shasi threads, as we mentioned many times, that go up and down, and then in the opposite direction, from left to right, you have the arev. And the arev is a thread that will go around and then come in again and then go around again, and that's how you weave something. So you have to weave two chutim. So you take the arev, which in English I think is called the, what's it called in English? Let me just see if he has it here. Anyway, I think it's called the No, not the warp, but the other one, the weft, I think it's called, W-E-F-T. All right, it doesn't matter. The English is not important. There's the sea that goes up and down many threads, and then you take the orev and you thread it in and out. So you have to do it with two different threads in order to be chayv. But the question is, at the end of the day, depending upon the width, you know, you could have many different threads of shasi, or you could have less threads of shasi. What do you have to end up with after you weave in these two threads of arev? What you're left with is kimlo rochav hasit. Right? Before we talk about twice the sit, now we're talking about once the sit. So for Ariga, once you weave two threads, as long as you weave it the size of one sit, you're chayav. And all that we'll have to take up when we get to Perek HaOreg. That's a different Perek. Alma, what do you see? Kevan delitvia koi, shiura ke tavui. We understand that tvia, which means weaving two threads, that requires two threads, correct? We said that ha'oreg is shnei chutim, and therefore tova is going to be kimole rochav hasit kofel. But what about all the other malachas that are on this list, like whitening them, or disentangling them, or dyeing them? I mean, why do they have the same exact measurement as HaTova? HaTova is already a finished product. You've done all the necessary preparations, and you're just ready to spin two threads. Why is that same shear applicable to all the preparatory stages? And the answer is, Kevan Delitvia Koi, because since your purpose in whitening, etc., etc., is to create two spun threads, Ishira Kitavui. We're going to judge the potential by the same shear as the actual. Hachinami, if we apply, says Rav Nachman, the same logic to our case, Kevan Deliavdo Koi, Shiuro Kimeubot. Here too, when you have a piece of untanned natural hide, right, straight off the animal's back. So since its potential is to create a tanned piece of hide, therefore the measurement is always going to be exactly the same. So Rav asks the following question. The Shalola Abdo Bekama, what happens in a case when a man is carrying a piece of untanned hide, and he has no intention whatsoever to tan the hide? I understand your logic, Rav Nachman, and we saw it in Tviya and all the malachas that prepare for Tviya, that we look at the potential and we determine the shear and the minimum size by its potential. But that's only if he has in mind that he's going to take this untanned hide and he's going to tan it. But what if he wants to use the untanned hide in its natural state? Bekama, how much would be the shear in that case? You can no longer talk about the potential if he's not interested in actualizing that potential. It doesn't matter. In other words, since you created a hide that has the significance, it has the size that you can create an amulet, whether you will go ahead and create that amulet and first tan it or not, that's irrelevant. It's objective that for anybody else, you have the amount of hide that you need to create an amulet. That's how the Torah views the chashivas of a hide. So now Rava raises an objection from a braisa to Rav Nachman. V'lo shani, and you're saying there's no difference between me'ubot if it's already tanned, l'she'eno me'ubot if it's not yet tanned? Esve, I'll ask you a question from a braisa. The braisa says, Amotzi samonim, shruyim. Right, the samonim were the herbs that they used after heating them up in a cauldron and boiling them. They would emit a certain dye into the water. Now he's carrying out these herbs in their natural form. Kedei litzbor behen dugma le'ira. Right, so they had a certain kind of utensil which is called an ira in Talmudic language. It was used in the context of weaving, and it was a kind of a kli that made it was a utensil that held on to the arev and made sure that the arev didn't get didn't fall out of place. The arev always had to be in a certain place, And in order to create that kli, you needed to create an opening for the kli, and that opening in the kli is called an ira. And what they did was, since they used it in the professional occupation of dyeing, of weaving, they would often paint it a certain color. They would dye it. So we have a braisa that says that if you carry out enough herbs such that you can make a dye, which would be a dugma le'ira, then you're chayev. Ve'ilu b'samonim she'enom shruyim. But let's take the case of herbs in their natural form, and he's not putting them into a cauldron in order to extract the dye. Tanan, we have a Mishnah, and the Mishnah later on will tell us that klipe egozim u klipe rimonim satis upua kedelitzbob and beged katan lefi svacha. That if you have various kinds of raw materials and you carry them out into Rishus HaRabim, then the shear for these materials, like the klipe egozim on the coverings over the nuts, or for example the coverings over pomegranates, that's called klipe rimonim, and then there are other kinds of herbs which are used in the process of dyeing. The Gemara later on will tell us what exactly they are. They're called satis upua. He translates in the English as safflower or madder. Okay, these were all used in the process of producing dye. And how much did he carry out and violate in hotzah in order to be chayev? It's enough to dye a small cloth. What happens is that the women used to wear a hat, and you may remember this, we discussed that they would put a cloth on top of the hat, and that cloth is a larger amount than what we said about what was called Kidei Litzbar Bahem Dugma Le'ira. So again, if you're talking about herbs that are already in the cauldron, they're already producing their ink, then there's one shear. But we have a larger shear in order, if you have the natural herbs in their natural state before you boil them and create the dye, for that you have to carry out a larger shear. So we see very clearly that the shear is not defined by the potential, but rather we look at each object as is. If you have something that's already been processed, then there's one shear. If you have something that is in its natural state, it hasn't been processed, there's a whole different shear. And therefore, Rav objects in the case of a hide that it should be the same shear, whether or not it's after tanning or before tanning. So the Gemara rejects Rav's argument from the Braisa. Itmar Allah. We have a statement of Rav Nachman in the name of Rabba Bar Avuna concerning that Mishnah, and it says, "Lefi she'ein onem toreach lishro samimonim litzvah ben dugma le'ira." And it works like this: that if you have samimonim, which are herbs, and they're already cooking in the pot, then for you, it's significant enough if you could produce even a minimal amount of dye, which is dugma le'ira, as we discussed before, which would somehow close up this opening of that weaver's tool. But if you're talking about raw materials, if you're talking about herbs that have not been put into the cauldron, they haven't been in any sense processed yet, then a person would not, l'chatchila, when he's trying to decide what to carry around such a minimal amount of herbs. Because if the herbs are unprocessed, they're not significant until he takes out enough to create a cloth, to dye a small cloth. However, in the case of tanning, a person will trouble himself with a hide if it's large enough to make an amulet, even if it's not yet tanned, even if it's in its natural state. Rava again argues against Rav Nachman. What are you going to do with the case of garden seeds? Varei zarune gina. Dimakami dizarinu tanan, the shear of taking out these seeds before they were planted, is in the Mishnah later on, and the Mishnah says, Pachos mikigrogeres. Rabbi Yehuda ben Beseira Omer, Chamisha. So you need a certain volume of seeds, that you're carrying out X number of seeds, in order to give it that significance so that you would be liable. It's either a little bit less than a grogeres. A grogeres, we said many times, is a dried fig. Or it's 5 seeds. In other words, you want to plant in your garden, you're not going to plant anything less than 5 seeds. That's all when you talk about seeds in its natural form. Ve'ilu basa dizarinu. If you've already planted these seeds, Tanan, we have a Mishnah later on, and the Mishnah says, Zevel v'chol hadak, kidei lezabel bo kelach shel kruv, divrei Rabbi Akiva, chacham omrim, kidei lezabel krisha. So there's a machlokas recorded in the Mishnah about fertilizer and fine sand. Zevel is fertilizer and chol is sand. How much do you have to carry out in order to be chayav for meleches hotzah? According to Rabbi Akiva, you take a kruv. A kruv is a cabbage, kreit in Yiddish. And if you have enough fertilizer, which is a small amount, to fertilize a kruv, then according to Rabbi Akiva, you're chayav for hotzah, because you've already achieved enough. Now this is a smaller shear than we discussed when we spoke about kigrogeres or pochos mikigrogeres or 5 seeds. V'chachomim omrim kidei lezavel krisha, and krisha is a different kind of a plant. It's a leek in English. So all you need is fertilizer to fertilize a leek. But this measurement, which is even less than Rabbi Akiva, is certainly less than the amount that you would be chayav for, as we saw in the earlier Mishnah, if you were carrying out zarune gigina, means unplanted seeds. So once you have a stalk that's growing, whether it be the leek stalk, whether it be the cabbage stalk, then you have to take out enough of a significant amount to fertilize that. And in the case of a seed which hasn't been planted yet, let's take Rabbi Yehuda. It's a little bit easier. Rabbi Yehuda would say, let's say you had cabbage seeds, you'd only be chayav hotzah if you carried out 5 cabbage seeds. Whereas if you already have a cabbage seed that's growing, all you have to do is take out enough sand or fertilizer in order to fertilize that one single cabbage. So we see that we don't judge a shear by its potential. We judge the shear by its actual, and there's a difference between actualizing and potential. So therefore, in the case of tanned hide, we'll have a different shear than the case of untanned hide. Then Rav has another kasha. Varetit, let's talk about cement or clay. The mekami deligbele, before he needs them, right? Tit is made from a combination of sand and water. And you add the water to the sand, and you knead it together to make some sort of a concrete substance. And modim chachamim l'Rabbi Shimon b'motzi shofachim l'shusarabim. The chachamim agree with Rabbi Shimon that if you have shofachim, right, there are full sugyas about shofachim in Masecht Bava Kamma. These are waters that you throw out. It's already been polluted. They're polluted wastewaters. And you take it out to Rishus HaRabim. It might have the ability to fertilize a field. And the shear is a revius. Why? Because we're talking about a liquid, and the shear for Hotzah in a liquid is always a revius. Vavinen ba. And on that statement, in the Braisa, we ask a question, Shofachin l'may chazi, what are you going to do with these shofachin? Does he intend to use them as fertilizer? Amar Rav Yirmiyah, no. Legavel behen esatit. He uses it to knead the clay, to create this concrete substance. Ve'ilu basar de gable. So that's only when you're talking about this wastewater in its potential, in its raw state, so to speak, before you add it into the mixture with the clay. But basar de gable, after you've already done the kneading, then the Braisa teaches us, tit kidei lasus behem pikur. In such a case, you're liable if you take out enough to form an opening for a kli. This kli is called a kur, and that's a kli that's used for holding different kinds of liquids. And that's a much more minimum amount of clay than a revius. So we see the following, that if you're starting with, so to speak, you're starting from scratch, then we talk about a larger shear, and you have to get to the point of revius for the shofachin. But if you already have the tit, and out of this clay you want to form some sort of a kli or an opening for a kli, then you only need a smaller amount. So once again, we see Rava's proving, both from the case of garden seeds, and the difference between taking out garden seeds and once it's already been planted, and here also in the case of clay, we see that there's a basic difference between the water that you're going to use to knead the clay, and once the clay is made, there's always going to be a difference in the shear. So therefore, these are objections against Rav Nachman. So Gemara again defends Rav Nachman. Hasam nami kidam moron. We're going to use the same logic that we said before, that it's just not worth it for a person to start with a raw material that would only produce a small amount after he manufactures it. It's just not worth his tircha. A person is not going to extend himself. Legabel esatit, lasos bo pikur. You know, it's if he's starting the whole manufacturing process by adding water into clay and kneading them together to create concrete, then in such a case, he's going to want to make a larger amount. An amount that would fit a kli, an opening for a clay covering over a receptacle. And therefore the shear is going to be a much larger shear because he hasn't gotten to the point of gibel yet. Once he's already gotten past the gibel stage, then he only needs to carry enough clay that would serve as a covering over this utensil. But again, going back to what we said before, in the case of a hide, a person who is worth his effort to take out a hide that would be the size to create an amulet, even though he would have to subject that hide to the process of tanning, but nevertheless it's worth his while. And therefore the shear is the same whether it's tanned hide or untanned hide. Toshma, let's bring another kasha on Rav Nachman. The Omer Rav Chiya bar Ami, Mishmei di Ula Shlosha Orosein. There are three categories of hides, and each one has its own shear. There's something called matzah v'chipa v'diftera, and we go through all three of them. Matzah kimashmo, okay? So this is like the word matzah. What does it mean, matzah? Matzah is something that is just flour and water. You don't add anything to the matzah. So here too, in the case of a hide, Delo maliach, it hasn't been salted. In the process of tanning, you have to salt it. Delo kamiach, and you can't treat it like flour because you haven't really tanned it yet. Delo opitz, and another process in which they tan the hides required using certain kinds of nuts, which are processed called an opitz. The kamashi uro, and what's the shear, the minimum amount for hotzah of this matzah, this raw hide. And Tani Rabbi Shmuel bar Rav Yehuda kidei lotzur bo mishkoles ktana. You have to take out enough so that you can use it to wrap up a certain scale, right? They had a small scale, which is called a mishkoles ktana. And these are weights that were used back in the time of the Gemara when you sold something, so you wanted to know if you were getting the right weight. And these were made of different kinds of materials, most often from lead. And he would wrap the weight in a hide, and the hide apparently would protect the weight. So the weight, the scale, was made of a certain kind of a metal, and it was soft, so they wanted to protect it. So what would they use to protect it? They would use a hide. And in that case, even if the hide was natural, it wasn't treated, it was this matzah that we spoke about before, but if you have enough of a hide so you could wrap this scale, you know, the lead scale, then that'll protect it, that's enough. Comma, how much is that really in size? Omar Abaye, riva de pumpedisa. He says that in Pumpedisa, they had a certain kind of a very large scale for weighing things. And our case of a scale, which we said was Mishkolas Ketana, is 1/8 the size of the Pumpedisa scale. Chipa, now he has a hide that's already on a second level. It's been more processed, dimoliach, it's been salted, velo kamiach, velo alfitz, but it hasn't yet been treated in the other manufacturing ways, which means like flour they would add, or they would add these nuts, these gall nuts, the kamashi uro, and once it reaches the state of chipa, what's the shear? Kidei lasos kamia, or kidei lasos kamia, and you have enough to make an amulet. Diftera, Dimoliach ukamiach, that's the third level listed here in the Braisa. And that's already been treated with salt and with flour. It's 2/3 of the way to full production. And it hasn't been treated yet with gallnuts, with apples. Kamashiro, what's the measurement for that? Kidei lichtov alav esaget. A divorce, a bill of divorce, can be written on a hide, it's a kind of a parchment, even if it's not completely processed yet. And basically, what we have here are three measurements that go from the largest measurement to the less largest, the middle to the smallest measurement. And this is all reflective of how developed and how processed it is. How far down the line do you have it? So therefore, you see very clearly, against Rav Nachman, that we're not going to judge the hide and how much is significant by its potential. We're going to talk about where it is right now. How far down the line is it? And now we're talking about hides. All the other answers that we gave, well, it's not worth it for him to carry out the seeds and all that. That's not relevant to hides. Ketani miyas, we see clearly, kidei lotzur pi mishkolas ketana. We see that the shear, in the case of matzah, that was the largest of all the shearim. In other words, it's to wrap around the weight and protect the lead of the weight, of the scale. V'yomar Abai riva de riva de pumpedisa, which Abai pointed out as a quarter of pumpedisa. Now this is a larger requirement than an amulet. Right, as we said, there are three levels, and we're talking now about matzah. Matzah is completely raw. It hasn't been processed at all, and you need a larger amount in order to be chayav. So you see that we're not going to judge the hide by what it could be potentially down the line, right? But we're going to look at it as it is now. So the Gemara answers, Hasam bibishula. When we talked about matzah, Reb Chiya refers to a hide that has a moisture to it, and it cannot be tanned. So therefore, if it's a different kind of a quality of an entity, and it doesn't lend itself to tanning, then we ask ourselves, well, what is he going to do with it? And the answer is, he's going to use it to make this covering over the scale, you know, to protect the metal substance of the scale. But if you have an untanned leather that is dry and that is subject to or lends itself to tanning, then we view it already as if it was tanned, and it has realized its potential, and the shear is going to be identical to that of a tanned hide. Vatnan, what are we going to do with a Mishnah and Kalim? The Mishnah and Kalim says, Habeged shloshal shloshal imidras. You may remember that as far as a Zav is concerned, if he sits with his weight on top of a cloth, then the cloth becomes an avatuma, a very high-level tuma, intense. And what's the minimum size of a beged? It's got to be 3x3 tfachim. Again, that's for tumas medras. Hasak, you may recall that if he takes goat hairs and he makes a sackcloth out of it, arba, it means 4 tfachim square. Ha'or, if it's a piece of hide, is chamisha bal chamisha, 5 tfachim square. Mapots, if you're talking about a mat, is shisha al shisha. A mat is usually made of reeds, and all you need, and you'll need a higher shear, because again, each time you get a little bit more further away from something that's sophisticated, more raw, so to speak. And therefore, Tony Allah, the Brisa says, Habeged vasak ve'or kishir lituma kach shir lahotza. That with regard to these cloths, or sackcloths, or these hides, and that's the one we want to emphasize, the hide, the shear of tuma is the same exact shear as hotza. Now the shear for tuma, in the case of a hide, was 5x5 tfachim. That's a much larger measurement than what we spoke about in our Mishnah. And the answer has to be that we're talking about a natural hide that has not yet been processed. So we're not talking about the amount of hide that would be sufficient to create an amulet. We need 5x5 tefachim. I mean, again, a tefach is, let's say, it's probably a foot square of hide. It's a major piece of leather. So you see again that we're going to, the less processed it is, the larger the minimum requirement is going to have to be. So once again, we have an objection to Rav Nachman. So our answer is, Ahu, that Mishnah in Kalim is talking about Kartov Law. And Kartov Law is something that cannot be used for tanning. What is Kartov Law? It's already like we saw before, that if you have a moist piece of parchment, then you cannot tan it. It doesn't lend itself to tanning. And here what he did was he took the natural hides and he boiled them. That's very good to make furniture out of it, Rashi says, but it's not good enough to create some sort of tanned piece of leather. So if you have regular leather that's not, and it hasn't been boiled, and it could be used under the after the tanning process to create an amulet, then even though it hasn't been processed yet, you're chayev, says Rav Nachman, because you carried out enough that could be tanned and could make an amulet. But this case in the Mishnah in Kalim, that's a different case. And here we turn to Daf Ayin Tes Amud Beis. Now we get to a klaf. Klaf is the parchment, and it says Kidei Lichtov Olav Parsha Ktana, that the size of the parchment, in order to carry it out and be chayev in liability for Hotza, is the amount that you could write on it a parasha. There are many parashios in the Torah, but we're talking about a parasha ketana. We'll have to see exactly what a parasha ketana, a small section of the Torah, would be. Uraminu, what are we going to do with a brisa? The brisa says, klaf, vidustutumos, kidei lichtov olav mezuzah. Then in the case of parchment, or duchstustus, again we'll see later on what duchstustus is, but anyway, talking about hides that are used to make parchments, and the shear is to write on it a mezuzah. And the Gemara thinks that this is not equal to the shear of kedei lichtov olav parsha ketana. So a mezuzah actually has two parshios. It has Shema and Volume Shemoah. And you just told me that for carrying klaf, it's enough that you carried a klaf that could write one parsha. But this brisa says you have to carry out a klaf that's enough to write two parshas, namely a mezuzah. So how do we reconcile the Mishnah with this brisa? And Gemara answers, my mezuzah shebet tefillin. Okay, now what tefillin are we talking about? Now apparently, there's tefillin shel rosh, which has four parshios, and then there's tefillin shel yad that has one parsha. And what we're saying is that a mezuzah in this brisa is not what we think it is. It's not a mezuzah, but rather it's a scroll. In other words, it's a klaf that's rolled up. Also, the brisa used the word mezuzah. Now, if you have four batim in the case of a shel rosh, each one of those batim gets a mezuzah, meaning a small scroll. And the parsha that's written on the small scroll in tefillin, meaning the smallest of all the scrolls, is Shema Yisrael. So therefore, when the Brisa says that the shear for taking out a klaf is kedei lichtov al mezuzah, it's actually referring to Kriyat Shema, to the parasha of Kriyat Shema, which is going to be rolled up once it's written, and it's going to be placed into one of the four batim of the tefillin shel rosh. So therefore, there's no contradiction between this brisa and the Mishnah. The Mishnah says klaf kedei shiichtov olav parsha ketana, which is the same as kedei lichtov olav mezuzah, and we're talking about the parsha of Shema. So Gemara now says, wait a minute, is it really true that when the brisa used the word mezuzah, it refers to tefillin? V'kari lahu tefillin mezuzah? I mean, that's very confusing that you should use the word mezuzah to refer to tefillin. I mean, mezuzah is placed on a door, and tefillin is placed on your head. So the Gemara says, I'll prove to you, yes, that sometimes the word mezuzah is a reference to that rolled up cloth that goes into one of the batim of tefillin. But Tanya, we learned in a brisa, Ritzuos tefillin ima tefillin. Now, what we're discussing here is, again, Tuma Vitara, and Chazal made a takona. I think we learned it earlier in Masechet Shabbos, that if you write something, no, I'm sorry, it was in Masechet Brachos, that if you write something on a klaf and you touch it, then you contract what's called tumas yodayim. Okay, and we also had, if you remember, the Yud Ches Gzeros, that was at the end of the first chapter of Masechet Shabbos. And one of the various Gzeros there, the 18 Gzeros, is what's called Tumas Yadayim. That whenever you have a contact between your hand directly, and you didn't wash your hands properly, and holy scrolls, then your hands now contract Tumas Yadayim, which means that if you touch Truma, it will disqualify the Truma. And now, in this brisa, the Tanakhama, wait till we get to Rav Shimon, but the Tanakhama holds that not only was this gzera of Tumas Yadayim enacted with regard to the klaf itself, but even to all the other parts of the tefillin. For example, even the ritzuos, the straps of the tefillin, they're also included in this decree, as long as they're attached to the tefillin. That's called imat tefillin, they're attached to the tefillin. It's metamos esiyadayim. Bifnei atzmon, what happens if your straps were removed from the tefillin? Ein metamos esiyadayim. Okay, that's according to the Tanakhama. Rabbi Shimon ben Yehuda Omer, Mishum Rabbi Shimon Hanogea Biritsua Tahor. Even if he has direct contact with the ritzua that's attached to the tefillin, that's not included in the gzera of Tumas Yadayim. Ad shiyagia, ad shiyiga b'ktsitsa, until he touches the boxes of the tefillin. In other words, the boxes of the tefillin, what we call the batim, they were included in this gzera of Tumas Yadayim. because they actually contain the scrolls inside of them, but the straps don't contain any scrolls at all, and therefore they weren't included in this gzeirah that only applies to the klaf and anything that protects the klaf. Rabbi Zakkai Mishmo Omer. Rabbi Zakkai has a slightly different version of Rabbi Shimon, and according to his version, Tor Achiyiga b'mezuzah atzma. What does that mean, mezuzah atzma? We're not talking about a mezuzah here. The subject of this braisa is tefillin. And we were discussing whether it's the bottom of the tefillin that included in this gezeira, whether it's the ritzuas of the tefillin. All of a sudden, we have a new version of Rav Shimon, and he says, you're tar until you touch the mezuzah itself. What do you mean the mezuzah itself? Well, who's talking about a mezuzah here? The answer is, we're talking about the klaf on which the parsha is written, and then placed inside the bayis. So we're talking about the tefillin themselves, meaning the scrolls that generate the kedusha. So we have three shitas in this braisa. Under what conditions do you generate a tumas yadayim? Number one, according to Rav Zakkai, it's only if you touch the scrolls themselves, the klaf themselves. I can show you a klaf of tefillin here in my drawer. The second shita is Rabbi Shimon, the way we have Rabbi Shimon, not Rabbi Zakkai's Rabbi Shimon, and therefore you have to touch the batim of the tefillin, obviously the scroll as well, but even the batim. And then we have the Tanakhama, this Brisa, who extends the Tumas Yadayim to include even the Ritzuos as long as they're attached to the tefillin. Hamidik Tani Seifa, from the fact that it says in the end of this Brisa, it says Klaf. But wait a second. You can't tell me that in one braisa the word tefillin appears and then the word mezuzah appears. That's inconsistent. You can tell me that sometimes you'll find a braisa like the braisa we just learned in Tumas Yadayim, that the braisa used the word mezuzah as a synonym for the klaf of tefillin. But in our braisa that we've been discussing, the braisa speaks about a klaf of tefillin. And the braisa says, you're chayav for carrying a klaf as long as you can write on it a small parsha of tefillin. And what is that small parsha of tefillin? The smallest of all the four parshios, Shehi Shema Yisrael, Shema Yisrael. Mechlal de Reisha, we go back to the Reisha, and the Reisha uses the word mezuzah, and there it says that my mezuzah. I'm sorry. It says in the braisa kedei lichtov olav mezuzah, right? So you know when you talk about a braisa that mentions a klaf for tefillin and then it mentions a mezuzah, it cannot be that reference called mezuzah is to the klaf shel tefillin. That the word mezuzah in this braisa is referring to a mezuzah. You know, you wouldn't use the word tefillin to refer to the scroll of the tefillin in one part of the braisa, and then in the reisha you call that same scroll of tefillin on which my Yisrael is written a mezuzah. But rather we're talking about a mezuzah. And therefore, if the first part of the braisa is talking about a mezuzah, now we're back to the contradiction that we had before. And that is, when are you chayav for carrying a klaf? Is it a klaf for tefillin, or is it a klaf for mezuzah? If it's a klaf for mezuzah, the minimum size is that you can write two parashiyos. If it's a klaf for tefillin, for Shema Yisrael, that's only one parasha. So well, when are you going to be chayav? What is the shear for Hotzos HaKlaf? And the Gemara says, Hachi Ktani. Here's what the Braisa has in mind. Klaf Udustustus. Shi Uron Bekama. Dustutus Kidei Lichtov Olav Mezuzah. And Klaf Kidei Lichtov Olav Parsha Ktano Shebetfilin Shehi Shema Yisrael. Now, we're going to have a Gemara about what exactly is this duch sus tus, and the status of this particular kind of a klaf in terms of tefillin is going to be an issue, but certainly it's fine for mezuzah. Now, we have to understand that sometimes the standards and the requirements for tefillin are greater than that of a mezuzah. So if he's taking out something that could be used for a mezuzah, and it could not be used for tefillin, then he's going to have a shear that you could write two parashios. And that's going to be the shear for someone who carries out duchsostus. I'll try to get that right, pronounced right, duchsostus. But if he's carrying out klaf, and klaf is fine for tefillin, then he's going to be chayiv as long as he can write Shema Yisrael, the smallest parasha for tefillin. However, this is not necessarily so, that we can make this distinction between these two materials. Why? Because Omar Rav is of the opinion that duchsustus hare hi kiklaf, that it really has the same status in halacha. And if it's kosher for a mezuzah, then it's kosher for tefillin, for a klaf shel tefillin. So the Gemara explains, ma klaf kosvin ol tefillin. Rav means to say that just like you can write tefillin on a klaf, af even duchsustus kosvin ol of tefillin. So whatever this material is, it's kosher for tefillin according to Rav. Now again, we're a little bit in trouble here, because if we're saying this is kosher for tefillin, so you wonder why the Braisa would say that the shear is for tzah in this case is going to be lichtov all of mezuzah. I mean, after all, it's fit for writing a parsha of tefillin. So that should be a smaller shear, like we said, klaf is kedei sheyichtov all of parsha ketana, which is Shema Yisrael. So we're going to have so the Gemara is now going to face this question. Tanan, we learned in our Mishnah, klaf kidei lichtov parsha ketana shebet tefillin, that if he carries a klaf, it's to write one small parsha, Shishma Yisrael, klaf in duchstumus lo. But apparently in the case of duchstumus, you need a larger shear. As we said before, it's only good for a mezuzah with two parashios. The Gemara answers, le mitzvah, although the Mishnah seems to imply that klaf can be used to write tefillin, however, that's only not likuva, but if all things are perfect in the ideal sense, then you would write tefillin on klaf. But it doesn't mean to invalidate duchsustumus, because duchsustumus is also going to be kosher for tefillin. Not your first choice, but b'di'evet. Okay, Rabos, I see it's getting very late. Let me just try to add one little piece, and then we'll try to finish this up tomorrow. Toshma, we learned in a brisa, Aloch L'moshe Misinai. What do we learn from Sinai? Is tefillin al klaf, mezuzah, al duchsustus. Klaf b'makom basar, duchsus b'makom sear. So now, we're going to try to prove from this brisa that duchsustus functions in a different way than klaf shel tefillin. It's fine for seyar, you know, there's aloch l'moshe misinai that on the top of the tefillin shel rush there has to be some hairs, and believe that we'll talk about that tomorrow. And the Gemara once again says l'mitzvah, that the requirement of using klaf for tefillin to the exclusion of duchsustus is only l'mitzvah. That's only l'chatechila. Okay then, so let's make a note. We're here on Daf Ayin Tes Omid Beis, and we got a little bit before the Tosfos, what's parallel to Tosfos for Ha Midik Tani Sefer.